It's a regular meeting of yourself if you're not speaking. The President Alexander, Commissioner Ming.
Here.
Commissioner Chi. Commissioner McLeese.
Here.
Commissioner Newman.
Here.
And Commissioner Williams.
Here.
We have a quorum, and next is our land acknowledgement.
The Building Inspection Commission acknowledges that we are on the unceded ancestral homeland of the Ramaytu Shalone, who are the original inhabitants of the San Francisco Peninsula. As the indigenous stewards of this land and in accordance with their traditions, the Ramaytu Shalone have never ceded, lost, nor forgotten their responsibilities as caretakers of this place, as well as for all peoples who reside in their traditional territories. As guests, we recognize that we benefit from living and working on their traditional homeland. We wish to pay our respects by acknowledging the ancestors, elders, and relatives of the Ramaytu Shalone community, and by affirming their sovereign rights as First Peoples.
Okay, thank you. Next, for any members of the public that are listening in, the public comment call-in number is 415-655-0001. The access code is 2663-850-0172. And the WebEx webinar password is 1015. Okay. Okay, next is item two, President's opening remarks.
We have a very late start, so I will keep this very, very, very short. Thank you, everybody. And good morning. I just wanted to actually just publicly acknowledge the articles this morning around the Permit SF tech contract. And while the BIC is not part of the choice, we just want to, just acknowledge this and say and confirm our own commitment to upholding the highest standard of ethics. And as this, unfolds into, we'll let the process kind of unfold on its own, if there is one to be had. That's all. And we have a lot of great legislation to review today, so thank you. And some really new, exciting reports. So thank you, Director, in helping make that happen.
Okay. Thank you. Is there any public comment on the President's opening remarks? Okay, seeing none, item three, general public comment. The BIC will take public comment on matters within the commission's jurisdiction that are not part of this agenda.
I have, do you all have a handout copy?
Yes.
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 I think you're missing.
I'll share.
I'm ready. Thank you.
Okay.
My name is Jerry Drantler. In June of 2025, DBI Inspector Tienda performed a pre-final inspection of a $43 million building permit that expired 2 years earlier. There are 109 units in the building. Can the 109 condo owners at 2177 3rd Street continue to legally occupy their condos? Why is DBI approving special inspections in September of 2025 for an expired permit? TCO certificates in San Francisco are valid for a period not to exceed 12 months. The TCO issued to this building was issued 5 years ago and extended 19 times. I'm gonna change the subject. DBI should not have approved the issuance of an administrative permit to close long expired related building permits like the tower crane and foundation permits. Also, public records were illegally altered. I'm going to demonstrate that. And a document request for a transaction log that would identify the people who did this work was denied to me. This is the schedule of the TCOs. You can see the extensions that were issued after the permit expired were all approved by Kevin Birmingham, except for one, the chief building inspector. These are the relevant code sections that deal with permit expiration and TCO issuance. You can also see this is the Santos Urrea project. You can see here Inspector Chu approved a special inspection in September of 2025. You can see here that Inspectors Chu and Lopez should not have issued an administrative permit in July of this year to final three null and void permits, one of which is a $500,000 tower crane permit, and two of which are foundation permits. This is technical, so I'm going to skip it. You can see on slide 10, there's a $500,000 tower crane permit with no inspections, and the specials weren't approved. You can see in September of 2025, Inspector Tienda filed a $200,000 demo permit that expired in 2020 with no inspections. These are the two reference periods, May of this year and September of this year, and you can see the special inspections at the bottom of the $43 million permit were altered, and I've highlighted in yellow all the alterations. I asked for a transaction log report. It was denied. Next steps. The compliance manager, Mr. Bagheera, and DBI director need to explain to the public at a BIC meeting how DBI failed 109 condo owners, and the city needs to develop a plan to assist these 109 condo owners. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Is there any additional public comment, in person and remotely? Okay, thanks. Then our next item is item four, discussion and possible action regarding Board of Supervisors Ordinance, file number 250811, amending the building code to revise the timing of expiration of certain building permits and building permit applications. Continue from 8/20/2025.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Commissioners. Thank you, President Alexander Toot. My name is Raynell Cooper, and I'm a legislative aide for District 5 Supervisor Bilal Mahmood, sponsor of item 250811. Supervisor Mahmood is deeply interested in both good governance and helping housing get built. And as you'll hear from Tate later on in his presentation, this item does both of those things. Currently, San Francisco's permit renewal framework is out of sync with nearby jurisdictions. Our system in which permits renew on different timelines based on building valuation adds unnecessary confusion, especially for those with projects in other nearby cities. It also means that no matter how much progress is being made on a project and no matter how little has changed in their planning, builders have to repay to renew their permits at arbitrary milestones. This legislation streamlines this process by adding a flat 2-year expiration date for permit applications and 1-year expiration date from when permits are issued to when work can start. This 1-year deadline resets when any progress is made, whether that's an inspection or a site permit addendum. This means that builders can continue their work as long as progress is being made without being required to return for permits. In addition, we intend to introduce an amendment at committee to modify another aspect of building permit timelines, reaffirming the validity of building code that was valid at the time of application. There's no rule against using building code under which an application was submitted, and yet, due to a current provision in the code, projects in our city have faced, projects in the city can have those permits postponed or have the progress postponed, which increases costs, often resulting in further delays to building much needed housing. As an example, a project in our district located at 400 Divisadero has been delayed for several years due to the challenging financial environment many projects face, further exacerbated by a DBI request to update the project building codes in their plans to match the newer codes implemented by the city since the time the project was originally submitted. Not only would the changes requested have been costly for the final construction, but the request itself would have cost time and effort at a very pivotal point in the production in the project's development, estimating nearly $4 million. The supervisor's proposed amendment would align our local code with the state building code and provide increased stability for project planning. As we know, any delay can be costly for projects, creating more delays, an endless cycle, preventing new units in our city. We hope this amendment reduces headaches on projects like 400 Divisadero that are working their way through the development process across the city in this difficult climate for affordable housing financing and housing financing in general. We're pleased to have worked with Tate Hannah from DBI and Peter Miljanic from the City Attorney's Office on this legislation, as well as Madison Tam and Supervisor Dorsey's office. We also thank Supervisor Dorsey for his co-sponsorship on this legislation. I ask for your support of this legislation, and I'll now turn it over to Tate with a presentation, but I'll be here to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rainelle, and thank you to Supervisor Mahmood. Good morning, Commissioners. Tate Hannah, Legislative Affairs Manager. Before I get into the presentation, this draft of amendments was distributed to you. Rainelle just mentioned in his presentation, his talking points there, that this is an amendment request that the supervisor is supporting, that the CAC has unanimously supported. And in my presentation, I will refer to the provisions in this amendment set. We're still waiting for a draft from the City Attorney's Office, but we're hoping to amend that in once we get to Land Use Committee, if you all approve and move this ordinance forward. So again, this is file number 250811. If we could go to the next slide, please. So currently, San Francisco utilizes a somewhat unique process to determine how long permit applications and permits themselves stay active. San Francisco is the only major jurisdiction that utilizes valuation to determine how long a permit or permit application should stay active. And you can see on the presentation there that we typically split it up between $1 and $1 million for applications, or $1 and $100,000, and progressively add time as the valuation increases. The ordinance before you seeks to amend San Francisco's application and permit timelines by providing a clearer standard timeline for these projects regardless of valuation. So as Rainelle mentioned, for applications, it's a 2-year flat timeline, and for permits, it is a 1-year rolling timeline to commence work. And this follows the California Building Code closely, especially on the building permit side. It diverges a bit on the building application or permit application side, but would align us much more closely with state code than we currently are. So under this ordinance, applications again receive a 2-year timeline. If a permit has been issued at that time period, or if a permit has not been issued at that time period, the application is deemed expired. Extensions of 180 days may be granted by the building official so long as there is justifiable cause. There's no maximum on those extension limits. Typically in other jurisdictions, you'll either see this timeline be a year, or if it's 2 years, they cap out with 1 to 2 extensions. We're trying to provide a little bit more discretion for projects that may take a bit more time, allowing those 180-day extensions to be used as needed, so long as there's justifiable cause. With regards to permits, this is where it gets a little bit more complicated. So there is a 1-year timeline to commence work. So once you get the permit issued, you have 365 days to show any form of commencement of work. That could be an inspection, that could just be a commence work inspection. Once you have done that, that 365 timeline, it refreshes. You then have 365 days from that commencement of work to show additional progress. Let's say after that 365 days, you get another inspection logged in 200 days, your timeline then resets again to 365 days. The intent here is to have the projects that are showing continuous progress to just stay active and stay alive without having to come in, ask for extensions unnecessarily. And this, again, has a 180-day extension capability, but we've added a one-time maximum extension for actual permits. That does align with the California State Code. San Francisco also has a unique process around site permits, and so we've tailored this permit timeline to apply to site permits as well. The base site permit that is issued is that start date for that 365-day timeline, and then any addenda that are submitted after the fact are considered a commencement of work. So essentially, you get that site permit, you have 365 days to submit your addenda, that will continue the timeline, and you just continue going from there as you submit addendas on a potentially yearly basis. As mentioned, the department and the sponsor, Supervisor Mahmood, are proposing amendments seeking to clarify the language regarding application timelines. The current language in the ordinance, not the amendment proposal in front of you, had a similar rolling timeline for applications. That is similar to what the state uses, but when we were talking to folks within the department, there was a bit of confusion and consternation on how exactly we would log that. And so to make things clear for the applicant and to make things clear for the department, we went with a 2-year timeline, which does follow other major jurisdictions. Cities such as Fresno and I believe San Jose, as well as San Diego, have this flat building permit application timeline. Additionally, as Rainelle mentioned, there is a provision in San Francisco's building code that is not present in the California code that talks about if an application is extended beyond the time that new codes are adopted. So say you applied in 2021, you get an extension that crosses over when we've adopted the 2022 building codes. the department may request that your application be brought up to modern building codes. It's not a shall, and that's not present in state code or in some other major jurisdictions. Once you are locked in and you have applied, you are set and entitled to that building code that you applied under. So this amendment would remove that that discretion the building official has and just aligns fully with the state code. As mentioned, the CAC reviewed this ordinance, as did the Administrative and General Design Subcommittee. Both provided a unanimous recommendation of approval with one requested amendment. It is to include a provision that essentially states that the building official will not unreasonably deny application extensions. I think the department, frankly, feels that amendment blurs some of the discretion there. We think the discretion that's written out in the application or in the amendment proposal provides that discretion. The CAC also noted that the department has been quite lenient with extensions in the past and has been trying to work with applicants and provide them where necessary. So that's where the department stands on that recommendation. Happy to answer any questions about this ordinance.
Thank you. Is there a public comment on item 4? Is there none remotely? Okay, then, commissioners.
I have a question regarding locking in the building code. And I understand that is typical. I would agree with aligning that. Is there a consideration on a limit to that? You know, if they keep work open, how many building code cycles can they stay behind? And should we, I know there's not a limit in the state code, but I would recommend that for consideration.
Certainly. That hasn't been considered for these amendments, but obviously have to take any big recommendation to land use.
I mean, my recommendation would be not more than 2 to 3 code cycles behind. I think that's reasonable.
I think that is the theory behind expiration dates on permits, but the automatic extension, I think there is a curiosity. Is there any, has there been any concern raised about how long these permits can stay open? And I guess to the commissioner's point, code cycles, some things change a lot, some things don't change. You know, what has there been any discussion or consideration regarding exactly how long, and does this actually, encourage bad behavior?
So there was a discussion when we were meeting with the supervisor over removing that discretion. I don't think there was a determination on a specific year or code cycle quantity. I think the general feeling, and maybe I can defer to some of my colleagues, but between code cycles, there frankly aren't that many substantive changes. A lot of the times it's on, the electrical side or things of that nature, which aren't core to necessarily the building's functions. We could see projects that are open for quite some time, and the detriments of that are, yet to be seen. I would just note that state law allows for this to occur, and so at the state level where folks are reviewing these code cycle updates, they've determined that it's not a necessity to have some sort of backstop at, X yeah. number of cycles that have been
yeah,
updated.
I understand. I support this legislation, so no need to interrupt me. I understand. I will call on you just a second. Oh. I just wanted to finish up. Sure. You will have your opportunity, Commissioner. No problem. Don't worry. And then my other question was just, how are you going to track this in the system? I know there's been issues and concerns about tracking expiration dates as is. This seems a little bit convoluted. I support the legislation just in terms of the department's thinking about how to enact this. Do you have any thinking about that or in the system?
We do, yes. So that's partly why this amendment proposal is before you, to change the application side, is because when we were thinking of how that would be logged and tracked properly, questions were raised that, frankly, there weren't sufficient answers. On the building permit side, where it is that rolling date, we have sufficient logs in the actual, on PTS, it will say when an activity has occurred. And so if an applicant is just doing work on their own and there isn't some form of activity logged with the department, that is not sufficient. There needs to be activity logged with the department. And so we have those categories in PTS that are pre-existing. We will continue to use those. One other thing that I will note with this that I apologize for not bringing up earlier, there's a 6-month delay from the enactment date on this, which is not typical for ordinances. We put that in to bake in time for the department to ensure that we have this system set up and running and there's no confusion on expiration date or any of that timeline will be very well set up by the time that this takes effect.
And I guess my final question is just, does there something does the inspection have to be successful in some way? And I mean that to, I don't want, you know, arbitrary calls to the department just to come out to log something to get an extension in the, is there a scenario where somebody gets called out and there isn't work, you know, like how are we, is there, and are we tracking progress? Are we, you know, what is the, is there something that has to happen in that inspection?
The language of the ordinance doesn't get into the specifics of that, and so I think that that is, would really be up to the discretion of the department. If you are calling us out there and there's truly been no work done, the ordinance talks about successful work being logged to the department, and so I think in those instances we would say that there hasn't been work done. This was, you know, an unnecessary inspection, and the timeline would not continue from there.
Thank you.
And those are the kinds of details that we want to clarify and flesh out within that six-month time period before this is enacted.
I appreciate that, and thank you for the six-month delay. That's helpful in understanding the department's approach. Commissioner Newman?
So I was just going to make a quick comment regarding the expiration or, like, the permitting timelines and, like, locking in the code at times. For typical jurisdictions, your entitlements expire at a set amount of time, and you have to go back and either get your entitlements reapproved, and then you, or they ask you to update them. So that's how, like, that mechanism works for the state ordinance working with most localities. But San Francisco is special in that, like, what we have is a system of, like, constant permitting. And so, you know, the permit that is in effect our entitlement. I think that I agree, there has to be a clear expiration timeline on that entitlement so that we're ensuring that as far as, like, the code cycle lock-in, that we're able to determine that there haven't been substantive changes that really affect health and safety or have been big improvements to health and safety or environment that we're not able to capture for a project that hasn't moved forward. I'm also incredibly sympathetic because oftentimes those add huge costs to your project, and I've definitely been stuck in that with projects that I've worked on where it's just taken so long to get to a point where we can finance it, and then we're in a new code cycle and we have to update, and now we have, you know, more money to make up or bake into the project. I generally am always a fan of anything that puts us in closer alignment with state code, so I support this ordinance.
City Attorney, can you provide some guidance? The action before us is to recommend the ordinance with amendments. Is that correct?
Deputy City Attorney Rob Cavalet, it would be to recommend the ordinance with or without amendments, or whatever the commission decides.
That's correct.
But okay. You have to move forward with the ordinance, passing it back to the Board of Supervisors, or determine if you need more time, or determine if there are other things you would add or change about the ordinance, and pass those along as recommendations to the board.
Okay, great. Based on the City Attorney's comments, are there any other recommendations or questions? Seeing none, move to recommend the ordinance with amendments.
There a second?
Second.
Okay, so I'll do a roll call vote on the motion. President Alexander Toot?
Yes.
Vice President Ming?
Yes.
Commissioner Calabucci?
Yes.
Commissioner McLeese?
Yes.
Commissioner Newman?
Yes.
And Commissioner Williams?
Yes.
Okay, the motion carries unanimously. Okay, thanks. So the next item is item 5, discussion and possible action on proposed administrative bulletin 00X, steel for post EQ inspection, evaluation, repair, and retrofit of pre-Northridge steel moment frame buildings.
And Sonia, do you have the slide deck, or should I?
Yes.
Oh, thank you.
Come up.
Mm-hmm. Great. Good morning, commissioners. My name is Laurel Matthews. I work for the Office of Resilience and Capital Planning, and I've been working with DBI on two administrative bulletins related to post-earthquake damage assessment of concrete and steel buildings. This presentation covers agenda items 5, 6, and 7, so I'm bundling them. Next slide, please. These two administrative bulletins, plus an appendix to the steel administrative bulletin,
have been recommended for approval by the Code Advisory Committee and the Structural Subcommittee. One, as you might guess, focuses on older concrete buildings, and the other focuses on a building type called pre-Northridge welded steel moment frame buildings, which I'll describe a little bit later. Next slide, please. The goal of these administrative bulletins is to support safe and rapid downtown recovery after an earthquake. An initial rapid evaluation and, in some cases, more detailed evaluation, which involved building tagging of either a green, yellow, or red tag. Some buildings, damaged buildings or possibly damaged buildings, will require an engineering evaluation to determine to what extent the structure has lost capacity due to the earthquake. And this is the part of the process where these administrative bulletins seek to improve and standardize the process. Next slide, please. Currently, there are some parts of the code, like the Chapter 4 repair provisions, that require capacity loss to be calculated. For example, the definition of substantial structural damage in the code says that the lateral force resisting system has suffered damage such that the lateral load carrying capacity, sorry for the technical language, has been reduced by more than 33% from its pre-damage condition. If you were a building owner, how would you and your engineer determine whether your structure had lost 33% of its pre-earthquake condition? So in the past, the City of San Francisco has published administrative bulletins which provide guidance for how to do this for certain types of buildings. One focused on wood frame residential buildings with three or more units, one focuses on concrete buildings, and one focuses on 1 to 2 unit homes. So this project updates Administrative Bulletin AB 99 to reflect new engineering guidance, and it also creates a new administrative bulletin to focus on pre-Northridge steel moment frame buildings. Next slide, please. So in the update to AB 99, the major task was to incorporate updates from new guidance that FEMA has released earlier this year, called FEMA P2335. And we also aligned the AB with upcoming 2025 building code updates, expanded the applicability of the document to a broader, subset of concrete buildings. And there's a section of the original AB focused on infill buildings, which was not substantially updated, but there were some minor updates made to the references so that if someone's trying to use the document, they refer to the right places of the current code. The second task, as I've mentioned, is to develop a new administrative bulletin focused on steel buildings. If you haven't heard of this building type, I'll explain it on the next slide. But just to describe what we did, this proposed new administrative bulletin follows the same structure as AB 99 and therefore imports some of the logic of that new FEMA document I mentioned. However, we didn't have brand new guidance to work with in developing this AB. The best guidance available for steel moment frame buildings is called FEMA 352. I'm sorry for all the numbers. And this was released about 26 years ago. Therefore, we went through this guidance document from 1999 and made some modifications and markup in order to align it with more modern engineering standards, like, if you're familiar, ASCE 41 and some new Stanford research. As a heads up, there was one small change to the definition of substantial structural damage that has been changed in the steel administrative bulletin before you, but has not yet been changed in the version of the appendix that you have. This is just going to change the number 33%, or sorry, from 30% to 33% in that substantial structural damage definition to align with what's currently in the code today. So if you approve that, we'll finish making that change before we publish. Next slide, please. So really quickly, why are we focusing on these two building types? For concrete buildings, I presented to this commission about concrete buildings before. They're brittle, they can be at risk to damage and collapse in a large earthquake. In the New Zealand Canterbury earthquake, there was a lack of alignment between the city, building owners, and insurers about the damage assessment and repair standards for this building type. One outcome of this lack of clear guidance meant that many buildings with pretty minor damage ended up being demolished rather than repaired because there just wasn't agreement on how to repair the damage. And finally, there's this brand new guidance available that I've mentioned. So that was why we focus on concrete buildings. In pre-Northridge steel moment frame buildings, the engineering community discovered in the 1994 Northridge earthquake in Los Angeles that this building type can sustain damage to important connections in the structure that sometimes can be initially hidden underneath fireproofing and finishes. So like the building might look fine, but you later realize when you peel off finishes that actually there's pretty critical damage. It's important to have guidance for when damage is likely enough that it's worth inspecting these welds and a process for inspecting them and repairing them if needed. And though the guidance is a bit outdated, there is guidance available as this in this FEMA 352. And of course, developing both of these administrative bulletins was recommended in San Francisco's Tall Building Safety Strategy. Next slide, please. So just to recap the goals of this administrative bulletin, they aim to provide consistent procedures for post-earthquake damage assessment, ensure that up-to-date national standards are used after an earthquake, identify efficiencies where possible, and just support recovery after an earthquake. Thank you. And I'm going to quickly hand it over to Steve Harris from the Code Advisory Committee and Structural Subcommittee to say a few words about these ABs. And then I'll be happy to take your questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Laurel. Good morning, commissioners. Steve Harris. I'm vice chair of the Code Advisory Committee and chair of the Structural Subcommittee of Code Advisory. And I would like to speak in support of these ABs and appendices. This is really, really useful stuff. The key really here is that Chapter 4 of the California and San Francisco existing building codes makes these triggers for upgrades in the event of damage, substantial structural damage, and disproportionate earthquake damage. But there is no indication as to actually how you determine that, and these ABs will provide that. And just an additional piece of information about the update, the appendix, which is an update to FEMA 352. This is an amazing piece of work, which FEMA 352 was prepared as part of the SAC project in the aftermath of the Northridge earthquake. But it has never been used because there have been no major earthquakes in the United States since that time. The people who were engaged in making these modifications were the original authors of FEMA 352, as well as professors and students at Stanford. And what we've got here, I think if FEMA ever gets funding to do it, they will be using it to update their document, but we will have the most up-to-date document with regard to these pre-Northridge steel buildings and their inspection and repair. So thank you. I'll be available to answer more questions if you have them.
Thank you so much for coming. Public comment, okay. Is that right?
Thank you. Is there any public comment on item 5? Any remotely? Okay, did commissioners have discussion or any questions?
Other questions, comments? Right and then left.
Expert.
I'm very familiar with the documents. I would say Christchurch is a unique condition of the insurance industry and how it worked there, which is very different from here. My bigger question is how are these documents in the event being disseminated to the people doing that work? There's a gap that I see in that. The city has a BORP plan, which I think is a great program, but it's up to the building owner to determine that. So is there any thought by your purview to kind of mandate that or bring that more fully into these downtown buildings using these documents?
That's a really good question. So I think there's two questions. One is, once these ABs are published and this appendix of this edited FEMA 352 is published, how do we make sure that people have access to that document and are aware that that's a document they should use? Is that one of the questions?
Access and knowledge. I mean, in the event of an earthquake, many of us, including myself, will be out there tagging buildings, and we'll be going based on our judgment. How are we letting those people know that these documents, like, how is that being disseminated to your people doing the tagging?
That's a very good question.
That they know how to use them.
I mean, I think it would need to be targeted to the people who are focusing on these bigger and more complex buildings. And Steve, it looks like you have a comment too. Yes.
The key is that these documents are not to be used in tagging.
I think that's, maybe the question here.
Right. They're not intended to be used for tagging. The tagging happens beforehand based upon the guidelines in ATC 20. And what we're talking about here is stuff that happens after the tagging. So you've got a building that is yellow tagged, or it's red tagged, or even it's green tagged, but there is indication that there has been damage in the area and we want to go back and have a look at it. That's the point at which these documents are engaged. It's not during the initial tagging process.
Okay, so the 33% is just whether or not they need to do a repair? Is that what we're proposing?
All structural damage is required to be repaired. It's only these triggers pertain to whether an upgrade is also required.
Thank you.
Okay.
And these guidelines are to be used by DBI staff, or who is using these guidelines? These are for contractors and their second?
So we envision that the report produced and the evaluation done will be done by the building owner's design professional or engineer. And the way this will help DBI staff is that they will have a document to point to when a building owner says, how are we supposed to know if our building has lost 33 in capacity? We have a concrete building or build steel monument frame. They can just say, do this. And it creates sort of like a point of connection between the building, but the actual work of developing the report would be done by the building owner's engineer.
And the triggering event is a 0.3 second spectrum acceleration. How does anyone know if that happens?
we now have a really good system put in place by California Geologic Survey and USGS. They create a shake map, and so you can immediately see what the shaking in your area is based upon these maps, which are available essentially in an automated fashion. If you have better information, for example, a ground motion accelerometer directly in your building, you can use that directly, but the shake maps would be available on a regional basis following the earthquake.
Thank you. And an inspection is mandatory, or is someone coming?
Yeah, I was mixing things. The tagging would happen independently. This is, if I'm going to restate it correctly.
Yes.
If there's a 33% loss, then you would be required to upgrade based on San Francisco Building Code versus just repair to original condition.
The triggers are California existing building code triggers. That's right. What we're trying to determine is whether the upgrade is required, and the upgrade that would be required is the reduced forces upgrade that exists for many other triggered elements.
So it essentially means you might have to upgrade the building to higher performance than it was prior to the event. And that's what this is the trigger for DBI, of whether or not you have to.
That's correct.
Get above that.
Yeah.
I'm sorry if this was already clear. Just want to clarify that the ABs do not change the fact the triggers already exist in the code, that if you have substantial structural damage, you potentially have to retrofit to better than pre-earth condition. This just describes how to determine if you have substantial structural damage.
Yeah, quite correct.
Thank you. I have no further questions. Is anybody else? No. Is there a motion?
Motion on the item.
I move to recommend, is it recommend approval of items 5, 6, and 7?
Just to clarify, Laurel, are we calling these all together?
I think that's fine. Oh, yeah.
Okay, then just let me just read the other items.
Sure.
Okay, so item six is discussion and possible action on proposed appendix to Administrative Bulletin 00X Steel 250808 FEMA 352 for AB00X. And item seven is discussion and possible action on proposed Administrative Bulletin 099 post-earthquake inspection, evaluation, repair, and retrofit requirements for concrete buildings. So, yes, so as to continue with Commissioner Ming's motion for items 5, 6, and 7. Is there a second for her motion? Okay, and so there was a motion and a second. Is there a public comment on this motion? Is there any remotely? Okay, seeing none, I'll do a roll call vote on the item. Items. So this vote is for items 5, 6, and 7. President Alexander Toot?
Yes.
Vice President Ming?
Yes.
Commissioner Calamucci?
Yes.
Commissioner McLeese?
Yes.
Commissioner Newman?
Yes.
Commissioner Williams?
Yes.
Okay, the motion is carried unanimously. Thank you. Next, we are on to item 8, discussion and possible action regarding the San Francisco amendments to the 2025 California Building Standards Code, including the building, existing building, residential, mechanical, plumbing, electrical, and green building codes, and updates to housing code.
Good morning, Commissioners. Tate Hanna, Legislative Affairs Manager. If we could pull up. Perfect. Thank you. As you all are likely well aware, the triennial code update process is one done by the California Building Standards Commission to reflect new national model codes and state-specific amendments. The process is designed to ensure the building codes are current with latest advancements in construction, safety, energy efficiency, and other standards. We are required by law to adopt these building codes by January 1st, 2026. DBI's Technical Services Division, TSD, has reviewed the updated state codes and provided recommended changes to ensure appropriate cross-references, accurate code sections, chapter numbering, and removal of any redundant sections. These proposals from TSD are non-substantive. They're exclusively designed to carry forward the existing San Francisco amendments to these codes. The Code Advisory Committee, beginning in April, has reviewed the recommended changes prior to these ordinances actually being introduced. All code sections received unanimous approval from the CAC and their relevant subcommittees, barring a few crossing of T's and dotting of I's, which have been corrected prior to introduction of these ordinances. The Code Advisory Committee then reviewed the actual ordinances themselves on October 8th and unanimously recommended approval of the ordinances. The department also recommends approval without any modifications. And then the final slide, in case it interests any of you, are the file numbers for each. I will note the housing code is separate than these other. It is not a mandatory replace and repeal. The housing code is a unique section in San Francisco, but we are updating it. It hasn't been updated in a number of cycles, and so we're replacing just some outdated cross-references and things of that nature. But despite it being a part of this package, it is not required by state law to be updated by January 1st, 2026. Happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you. Is there a public comment on item 8? And remotely? Okay, Commissioners? Questions on the presentation or motion?
Motion to recommend.
Is there a second?
Second.
So there is a motion by President Alexander Toot and a second by Commissioner Newman to recommend approval of this item. I'll do a roll call vote. President Alexander Toot?
Yes.
Vice President Ming?
Yes.
Commissioner Calamucci?
Yes.
Commissioner McLeese?
Yes.
Commissioner Newman?
Yes.
And Commissioner Williams?
Yes.
Okay, the motion carries unanimously. Okay. Next is item 9, Director's Report. 9A, Director's Update.
Good morning, President Alexander Toot, members of the Building Inspection Commission. I'm Patrick O'Riordan, director of the department. First, I want to let you know that we've introduced a new citywide addressing process that is faster, more transparent, and easier for property owners. This is a culmination of several years of work and planning by DBI, planning, public works, and the assessor's office, among other departments. The new process covers the entire life cycle of a building, from project approval to parcel creation to address assignment and removal, and is detailed in a new information sheet and step-by-step webpage. We quietly launched the new process last June so we could test it and refine it as needed. The soft launch was extremely successful. We cut the time it takes to assign an address by more than half. It took us less than 5 days to assign an address in July, August, and September, compared to 13 days in April and May. I want to especially thank DBI's Mary Wilkinson Church and Ken Hu for their good work and leadership in getting this across the finish line. Next, DBI teamed up with our partners at Permit SF to make it easier to legalize existing unpermitted storefront security gates. Plans, structural calculations, and installation details are no longer required for existing storefront security gates installed before August 20th of 2023. Instead, DBI is accepting a building code self-certification affidavit by the property owner. This streamlined process was based on the successful existing awning amnesty program, which helped legalize dozens of unpermitted business awnings. We believe these improvements will both benefit our customers, but also enable the city to serve the public more efficiently. And lastly, I want to say kudos to our inspection staff, plumbing and electrical inspection in particular, for answering questions from customer Alex Rexrod. And I quote, "Everyone was professional, listened to understand my concerns, and took the time to explain what to look for regarding work to be performed. The information provided was immensely helpful, and I appreciate the frank and clearly articulated explanations. Thank you, Mr. Rexrod, for your kind note, and thank you to our excellent electrical and plumbing inspectors for a job well done. Thank you, and this concludes my director's report. I'm available for any questions you may have."
Thank you, Director.
Thank you. Next, we have 9B, update on permit SF shot clocks.
Morning, Commissioners. My name is Megan Walsh-Bee. I'm the principal data analyst at DBI, and today I'm going to provide a brief overview of the shot clock metrics that were developed as part of the Permit SF initiative.
Hey, Megan, sorry, lower the microphone.
Oh, sorry.
Sorry. Yes, thanks.
I'm short. Okay. So DBI collaborated with numerous agencies, including planning, the controller's office, data SF, and the mayor's office, to agree to 5 measures that would be presented on public dashboards as part of the 100-day tranche of initiatives for Permit SF. These measures are in-house building issuance time with the goal of steady improvement, over-the-counter permit issuance time holding at a median of 1 calendar day, 75% of completeness letters being issued in 21 calendar days or less, first comments being issued in 30 calendar days or less, 75% of the time, and responses to revisions being issued in 14 calendar days or less, 75% of the time. And these public dashboards are available at the URL in the presentation. Okay. Permit issuance time is measured for in-house and OTC permits separately and can be examined by the last 12 months, 6 months, and 1 month. As you can see in the slide here, the median issuance times for in-house permits are trending downwards, and OTC issuance time is holding steady at 1 day. And we felt it was important to include both of these measures, even though most of the time the narrative is about the in-house issuance permit time, because 94% of our permits are issued over the counter. The next slide looks at the responsiveness of the city, measured by time to review the completeness of the submissions, time to review the first the plans the first time, and the time to review the resubmissions for corrections for in-house permits. The city has consistently met targets for completeness review and review of resubmissions. When we're looking at the first review time, and this is a pretty aggressive target, many of you may be familiar with AB 1114. The targets for that for housing-related permits were 30 business days for projects of 25 units or less, or 60 business days for projects of 26 units or more. So this is getting pretty aggressive at 30 calendar days. But what we have seen is that there has been a steady decrease. Compared to the past 12 months, the median was 14 days. The past 1 month, median is 7 days, and we're hitting that target right now 93% of the time. So the city has been making good progress in trying to review things as fast as possible. So that is an overview of these measures, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Is there any public comment on this? No. Commissioners, any questions?
Well, we usually take.
We do that at the end. I'm sorry.
For all of them.
I'm thank confused. It's a new item.
But yes,
it's the same
item.
Procedure. We'll do public comment at the end. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's do the same mm-hmm. procedure we
yes,
usually do. But
we will.
This is the new report. So thank you.
Okay. So at the end of item 9.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. At the end of item 9, you may be called up.
9C, update on proposed or recently enacted state or local legislation.
Good morning again, Commissioners. Tate Hanna, Legislative Affairs Manager. Prior ordinances that have been enacted, file number 250702. This expanded the existing all-electric new construction requirements to include major renovations. The mayor signed that on September 9th, and the ordinance took effect October 10th. Next, file number 240803, which expanded the expanded compliance control program to include non-building code violations, which was signed by the mayor on September 5th and took effect October 6th. File number 250191 is the audit amnesty program the department created to provide fee waivers and amnesty for existing non-compliance that arose out of the audit. The mayor signed this ordinance on September 5th and took effect October 6th. Ordinances before the board include file number 250657. This implements Senate Bill 937, which defers development impact fees for specified residential developments. That's pending a second reading vote before the board. And then lastly, file number 250630, which removes seven reporting requirements the department is responsible for. That ordinance is pending a hearing by the Rules Committee. Next is the state legislative calendar. So October 12th was the last day for the governor to sign or veto all bills presented to him. I will give a presentation next month, either in this item or a separate agenda item, whatever the commission would prefer, on some of the state laws that have been signed and will take effect come January 1st, unless they include an urgency clause. And as mentioned on this calendar, statutes typically do take effect on January 1st, and then the legislature will reconvene on January 5th. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next is item D, update on DBI's finances.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. Junko Laxamana, Finance Manager. Today, I have the final outcomes of the last fiscal year 24-25, in addition to the regular monthly update. I'll start with the last year's results. On the revenue side, mostly good news. Charges for services revenue exceeded the budget by $11.8 million. Interest and investment income revenue was $983,000 higher than budgeted. Fines, penalties, settlement revenue was $1.4 million higher than budgeted. Next slide. On the expenditure side, also good news. Salaries and benefit expenditures were on budget. Savings of $1.9 million in professional services and licenses and $3.9 million in services of other departments were realized. Of the $7.3 million in savings in the operating fund, $2.3 million was carried forward to this year, fiscal year 25 and 26, for work not completed or invoices not yet paid. Next slide, please. On the fund balance, we have six subfunds under the building inspection fund. Here we should focus on the first two sub-funds, operating fund and continuing project funds. These are general use. The remaining last four sub-funds are established for specific purposes, and they are restricted, and some are established by state mandates. After all of the sources, uses, and carry forwards are accounted for, the ending balance in the continuing project fund is $35.3 million. This is the amount that we often refer to as the reserve. Of this reserve, $11.9 million is budgeted to balance the fiscal year 25-26 budget. That makes the net available fund balance $23.3 million. This balance reflects the good news that I just reported on the revenue and expenditures, and it is significantly higher than what we projected a year ago. Next slide. Now on to this year's regular monthly update. At the end of September, 25% of the fiscal year have elapsed. DBI has collected $16.4 million, or 27% of the annual budget in charges for services. DBI has expended $16 million, or 18% of the annual budget in operating expenditures. It's still early in the fiscal year, so we're not yet making year-end projection at this time. We will report the projection halfway through the year in December, and again at 9 months in March. Next slide. Can you go back maybe two slides? Slide six. We're just gonna have a revenue table here, but revenue is coming in. Budget so far, we have collected 27% of the charges for services, which is our main sources of revenue. And on the expenditure side, which the table is missing, but I'll just speak to current year, salaries are just slightly under budget at 23% of the annual budget, and other expenditure categories are showing a low spending rate. This is typical of the first quarter of the year. And then finally, the permit volume and valuation. Total number of permits year to date is 2% higher than the same period last year. The total valuation year to date is 5% lower than the same period last year. And that's all I have today, and I'm available for any questions.
Thank you. Is there a public comment on the director's report items 9A through D? And any remotely? There's no public comment. Do commissioners have any comments?
Okay. I had a quick question on the permit SF performance measures for, and maybe it's just a general question to the other commissioners. The item for in-house building permit issuance time, the target is steady improvement. It seems like when does that sort of stop, because it seems like once you get to like max efficiency, there would be no more steady improvement, right?
Sure, yeah, there isn't. So in line with previous legislation where they set these targets primarily for how long does it take for a government agency to get you comments on that first time that they have a complete application for you, there hasn't historically been a target for how long does it take for us to issue you an application, because much of that is also dependent on the customer and how responsive they are, how good their plans are. So we don't really have a target for that, but we know that what we have seen is that there was a really steep increase during COVID where we kind of hit this peak, but where we are now is we're really getting back into that realm of where we were prior to COVID. And so I think that's kind of what we're hoping for, but there isn't really a hard and fast target.
I just want to say, so you've noticed some changes in the reporting, and this is obviously a new report that I think really focuses on, you know, some of the goals the department and the city has. So thank you so much for pulling this together. It's really clear. I'm trying to come up with a question just to engage you because it's very interesting, but it's very clear. So I just want to say it's great to see how well we're doing. We're very far above our 75% targets, which, you know, seem like a reach when they're just on paper. So I just want to commend the department for your work generally, but also just to be able to show it so clearly in the data. So thank you for your work on this. Just kind of for the commission and for the public. So we had been on our target. You notice that the inspections report isn't on here. We've been meeting our target for the last 7 years every single month. So that seemed like maybe not as necessary to talk about that report. We'll still be getting it quarterly. So we're not doing away with that. Just giving some room for a different report. So feedback would be welcome on that. And just in terms of the major building report, that's kind of already tucked into the DBI's finance report. On that last page, you see like the number of permits and the valuation of them. So that's still there. So we can, if you want to see other things or you want to see that called out in a different way, I just thought it kind of was silly that it lives in two different places. And since, permitting and completeness and moving projects along is one of the things that we all generally care about. I thought this report would be a good replacement or discussion point. So I would welcome folks' questions or feedback generally. Okay.
Okay, thank you. Next, we are on to item 10, update on DBI performance management.
Hello again, commissioners. We go one back. Thanks. Okay. Good morning again, commissioners. Megan Walshui, principal data analyst at DBI. As you've heard in many past presentations to the commission, DBI uses dashboards for a variety of purposes in our work, whether it be the audit. We've used them for ABE. We use them generally for tracking where our reviews are or how many permits we have coming in and how many permits we have coming out. And today I'm going to provide a brief overview of the different use cases that we've found for dashboards at DBI. So we have been leveraging the Microsoft Power BI Business Intelligence platform, and this enables us to bring together a variety of different data sets in a way that is interactive. So you can filter by dates, you can search for keywords and permits, you can filter things by staff, or looking at different priority types for permits that have come in. So really, this allows for data to be interactive, and it allows for you to answer questions kind of on the fly. It's a great feeling when I can say, we've got a dashboard for that. So this has been exciting work for me. One of our dashboards tracks the status of building permits and addenda that have come in and how long it has taken for them to be issued. So this is kind of one of our core dashboards. It allows us to see how many permits we have coming in of different priority types, of different form types. It allows us to look at the valuation and other characteristics, and it allows us to see what that trend in issuance time is. The way I like to think of that is really what is the age of the permits coming out, because we all know that not all of the permits that are issued in 2025 were filed in 2025. So there's nuance when it comes to reporting on dates, and these dashboards allow us to look into that. It also allows us to make sure that our OTC operation is going smoothly, our goal is to issue 60% or more of OTC applications within 2 business days or less. Gives us a little buffer if people needed to come back in to pay or something else. But basically, we consider that to be same-day issuance, and we've been doing really well on that. Another dashboard, and one that all plan checkers have access to, looks at the different plan reviews that are coming in specifically to their station or to them individually. So they can see how many plan checks do I have that are coming due, how long did it take for me to complete that, do they fall into different priority categories that in the past required sort of like different triaging and review times. It also allows us to look at the number of review cycles that these permits are done to have gone through. And as part of Permit SF, we have a new initiative where we're asking plan checkers to elevate to their supervisor when those review rounds have exceeded 3 and they had not yet been able to approve the plan, so that we have some level of intervention and technical assistance for our plan checkers in getting those across the finish line. Next slide. And we've used dashboards for many, many other purposes. We use them pretty much for all of our technical services compliance programs, including the facade program, the retired ABE program. We will be using it for concrete. We use them for different activities like the inactive application cleanup project that we've been working on right now. We have one for interactive exploration of our customer service results so that we can compare year over year and do some filtering by different applicant response profiles, and really for many, many other things. We have a lot of dashboards. And I'm going to go into two of them in a little bit more detail. Next slide. Okay. So one of the dashboards that we've been using lately is the inactive applications for cancellation dashboard. And what this dashboard enabled us to do was take all of those applications. It's important to distinguish between applications and permits, as Tate illustrated before with the proposed legislation. So these are applications. They have not yet been issued. And they have exceeded the amount of time that the code says that they should take for processing. But even on top of that, they have kind of laid abandoned for really extensive periods of time. So these have not been touched. They have no evidence of activity in over 360 or 720 days, depending on the valuation of the permit. And beyond that, we give them even greater benefit of the doubt. They've exceeded 360, 720, which is the timeline that they had from filing, plus kind of like a complimentary extension period is applied to that. So we're really making sure that we're being generous. This isn't necessarily like applying the code, but what we're trying to do is clean up this really large body of essentially abandoned applications that were in our system. And it was around 11,000, so going all the way back into like the 80s and 90s. So what we're trying to do this to service both the legislation that Tate talked about earlier today, as well as our migration to a new data system. This is a matter of data hygiene. And so this dashboard enabled us to find all of the over-the-counter building permit applications that had exceeded these timelines, and also filter out those that were related to notices of violation, because we want to give those a little bit of extra TLC and make sure that the complaint is all tied up in the way that it should be, because these permit applications were not actually issued or completed. So we've suspended over 10,000 over-the-counter permit applications that do not have a relationship to a complaint. And we are sending out in tranches notifications to the owners at these properties to let them know that the permit has been suspended and that within 60 days it will be canceled. And then we will go through and cancel all of them so that they're essentially, they're just not active anymore. When we move into a new data system, we don't have to worry about these applications that kind of live in both places. And we will be moving on to the in-house applications next. It's a much smaller group. A lot of these were over-the-counter because people are not paying fees before they create an over-the-counter application, so they kind of have less skin in the game, and it's not uncommon for people to walk away. Okay, next slide. And the other dashboarding application we wanted to highlight was this review cycle monitoring. This was also an initiative of PermitSF. And this is something DBI had kind of had a slightly unofficial policy that, you know, when it starts to get excessive in these review rounds, you should engage your supervisor. We're trying to tie things up more quickly. This has now been adopted by all of the agencies that are part of a building permit review. So they all have this on the books that they should be noticing when the number of cycles becomes excessive, exceeding three, and that they should start engaging supervisors. So this dashboard elevates those. These are permits or applications that are in filed status, have exceeded a certain number of review rounds at a station. And it highlights whether or not they've been approved, because you kind of can have those situations where we'll approve it, but then another department asks them to make a change, and then we have to review that over again, and it could lead for them to get new comments. So this is just really to enable staff to have that information that they need to have those dialogues, and whether that be that the supervisor coaches the plan reviewer on clearer comments that they can issue to the customer, or maybe it's a meeting with the plan reviewer, the supervisor, and the customer to hash things out over Teams or something like that. So these are some of the applications that we've been using for dashboards. We will continue to use them to support our work and make sure that we're making data-driven decisions, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Is there a public comment on item 10?
Good morning. My name is Jerry Drantler. Why do building permits not auto-expire in PTS like plumbing permits? And will building permits auto-expire in the future? Because if they did, there wouldn't be an 11,000 permit backlog. new point. DBI does a good job of responding to complaints. DBI does not do a good job of resolving complaints. A story in the Standard called out that 20% of DBI complaints are never closed. What is the performance standard for closing complaints? And why isn't there reporting? I came here months ago and talked about one that had been open for 4 years and mentioned it. I was concerned that I wouldn't be vertical when it was closed. So what is the performance standard? And there also should be an aging report monthly. What percentage of the complaints are over 6 months old? And then when they reach 12 months, there needs to be an action plan. This is a serious problem. Lastly, controls over administrative permits. These $1 get out of jail permits. They're used for all sorts of things. Addresses, signs, closing those 11,000 expired permits. So there needs to be some reporting on the use of admin permits. There are thousands of them that are issued and approved each year. And then there needs to be reporting by reason code. Why are there so many? Thank you.
Thank you.
Any additional public comment? I'm seeing none. Did commissioners have any comments?
Commissioner Williams?
Sure. For anybody, if we wanted to make the auto expiration of the permits just a standard feature, I mean, what would it require, like, mechanically to do that? I don't know the technology or anything, but what would it take?
Yeah, so it very important is to differentiate between the applications and the permits. So a permit is an application that has been issued. And so when we talk about expiration of permits, we're talking about permits that have been issued and have exceeded the amount of time that people have to do construction. When it comes to applications, what they would end in is a canceled state. So the application is canceled as opposed to expired. But, you know, I think DBI has at one point done an auto expiration of issued permits. It led to some problems because the logic is very complicated when it comes to the valuation, when it comes to whether or not people have filed for extensions, things like that. And so my hope is that absolutely in a more modern data system that we are going to enable both auto status changes as well as having a clear view to the customer when their time is up. Because right now we don't really provide a clear view of that on our PTS online. It doesn't show when an application is kind of getting to that timeline. We don't have an automated system in place that would mail letters to people saying, hey, you've got 60 days left to finish this up, otherwise we're going to cancel it, or otherwise we're going to expire it. So I think we need to have some more technological enhancements in place, but that is the direction we are going.
Appreciate with the volume that we have the difficulty in applying, you know, what a rule across big data sets, and knowing that there aren't problems in the system because it wasn't really set up that way or consistently maintained in that way. Director, when you look at these reports, I think it's really interesting how these were described. Just, you know, kind of broad strokes, like, where do you see kind of opportunities for improvement, or like where the department's going? Like, we're hitting all of our goals, like, you know, but obviously, like, we're still continuing to grow. What is your reaction to these reports, and where do you see the department growing and kind of your goals?
Number one, I'm very proud of what we've done and what our staff has done. I mean, it's very commendable. We've gotten to be in a fairly good place now as opposed to where we were. What can we improve on? We can improve on a lot of things, and I think one of the things we can keep improving on is with the use of technology, and we're on that journey. So I think these reports will continue to be provided to the commission, and we'll enhance wherever we can.
please.
I'm curious if there, as part of the dashboards, if there's also, like, is one of the metrics that's tracked is people who have had, like, the three NOVs within the 18-month period as to find, as part of the expanded compliance program?
So the question is, are we able to track which applicants have had three NOVs with, so, and this is why it is exciting to move into a new data system, because the quality of the data related to applicants is a little bit crude. The contractor data is a little bit firmer because we do have that number, but when it comes to all of the application agents, I mean, you should see how many different variations Rodrigo Santos used to record his name. It's like 50. So it's a little tricky to do that data analysis. So we haven't found a way to do that in an automated way. But when we do have a credentialing system where somebody has an account login, a password, I think that's going to be a lot easier. And that is the direction we're going. Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate your reports. And yeah, it's nice to see the department from a different view.
Thank you. Okay, next is item 11, Commissioners' Questions and Matters. 11A, Inquiries to Staff. At this time, commissioners may make inquiries to staff regarding various documents, policies, practices, and procedures which are of interest to the commission. And B, future meetings and agendas. At this time, the commission may discuss and take action to set the date of a special meeting and or determine those items that could be placed on the agenda of the next meeting and other future meetings of the Building Inspection Commission. And the next regular meeting is on November 19th. Are there any inquiries to staff this time or future items? And you can contact me prior to the next meeting.
Thank you.
Okay, public comment on item 11. Seeing none, item 12, review and approval of the minutes of the regular meeting of August 20th, 2025.
So moved.
Second.
So there's a motion by President Alexander Toot and a second by Commissioner Williams to approve the minutes. Is there any public comment? Seeing none, are all commissioners in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? And the minutes are approved. Thank you. Item 13 is adjournment. A motion to adjourn.
Motion to adjourn.
Second.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Okay, we are now adjourned. It's 12:29 p.m.